So thank you for inviting me to give this talk here. The subject of my talk may seem quite far from operator algebra theory, but you will see at the end, you will see during my talk that to provide a rigorous proof of the result, I use techniques from functional analysis and operator algebra. And for this, I received the help from Professor George Eliot, and I would like to take this opportunity to thank him for his help. So I'm going to talk about closed functions and exact functions in interacting particle systems. Before telling you what is a closed function and exact function, I would like to show you what is an interacting particle system. The interacting particle system that I'm going to talk about are models constructed to model random diffusion, to model surface diffusion. So what do I mean by surface diffusion? So imagine that you have a surface that evolves in time. And of course, the surface evolves in time because the atoms or molecules moves on the surface. We are saying that we have a surface diffusion because we assume that the atoms just walk on the surface, and no atom is born and no atom dies. So we are interested in describing how the surface diffusion affects the evolution of the surface on the macro scale. So what we do, we construct an interacting particle system that tells us what is the movement of atoms on the micro scale. So we assume that we have a surface with n sides, and the surface has one dimension, and the lattice of the side is periodic. So the atoms jumps on the surface. I'm going to call HIN the height of the surface at the side I over N. So it's the number of particles at the side I over N. And SIN is the slope of the surface at the side I over N, or it's the difference between two consecutive heights. Note that if we know all the slopes and the first height, then we know all the heights. So in this model, a configuration is the vector of the height or the vector of the slopes. Each configuration has an energy associated, which is given by this formula. So note that the energy of a surface depends just on the slope profile. So the configuration in this model evolves in time, and we would like to describe this dynamics. We will have a dynamic so that if at initial time we have two surfaces with the same slope profile, then they evolve in the same way, and at the later time we will have two surfaces with the same slope profile. So here is a rough description of the dynamics. Assume we have a particle at the side I. This particle may move to the left or to the right on the adjacent sides with a certain probability. So PL is the probability that it will go to the left. PR is the probability that it will move to the right. Now, the time between two jumps of a particle has an exponential distribution with a certain intensity. So the time between two jumps is a random time. And this intensity depends on the whole configuration. So if we multiply this intensity with the probability that the configuration will move from H to H nu, we get the rate at which the process will be updated from H to H nu. So here is how a configuration of heights and the configuration of slopes is updated if the particle moves to the right. And here is how the configuration of heights and the slopes is updated if the particles move to the left. Note that the configuration of slopes is updated by adding a vector negative 1 to a negative 1. So the dynamics in this model is the slope process is actually the Markov process supported on right continuous paths. It is called the jump process. It preserves the sum of the slopes in time. It has these measures as equilibrium measures. It's reversible with respect to the equilibrium measures, and it's ergodic if we fix the sum of the slopes. In other words, it will pass through all the configurations with the sum of the slopes fixed. So the law of the Markov process, what it does, it assigns a certain probability to each possible evolution of the system. If we want to describe this Markov process, we will have to write down the generator, which has this form, and here is the rate. So I should mention that in this model, the quantity of interest is the slopes, and is the vector of the slopes and not the vector of the height. So an interacting particle system in our case is this Markov process that tells us what is the evolution of the surface on the micro scale. We want to derive what is the evolution of the surface on the macro scale. And this is how we proceed. So we will define an object called the empirical distribution, which is a random measure. So it puts mass SIN over N at the side I over N. So you see, this is a random object. So therefore, this object is a random measure. If we know the empirical distribution, then we know the vector of slopes, so we know the slopes configuration. So this is how this measure integrates a test function. Note that the time here is speeded up by a factor n to the 4, so that in the limit, we will get a non-trivial motion. So N actually tells us what is the distance between particles. And if N goes to infinity, then the distance between particles collapses to zero. So if there is a limit of this empirical distribution, then that limit should give us the slope profile on the macro scale. So we will say that the sequence of empirical distributions corresponds to this profile if the probability of this event goes to zero. In other words, the sequence of these measures converges towards the measure with this density weakly in probability. So we are interested to know what is this density because it's a slope profile on the macro scale. So one of the questions about the model is the following. Suppose that at initial time, we assume that the sequence of empirical distribution corresponds to a certain profile, S0U. We would like to prove that this property is preserved at a later time, that at the later time, the sequence of empirical distribution corresponds to another profile, STU. If that is the case, of course, we would like to know what is the relation between the initial profile and the later profile. Usually it happens that this path is the solution of a deterministic equation started at zero u. And we also like to know what is the form of this equation. If an equation like this exists, it's called the hadronic scaling limit of the model. I will also like to add that if we prove that a diagram like this is true, then what we do is we show that if the law of large numbers is present at initial time, then the law of large numbers is also present at later time. A result like this is quite difficult to prove because we have an interacting particle system and we don't have independence in the model. I think initially people prove results like this in hydrodynamics. They prove results like this about fluids, and then they were stuck with this name. Yeah, so this really what we want to show is that if the law of large numbers is true at initial time, that then the law of large numbers is true at a later time. And unfortunately, it's difficult to prove something like this because the vector of the slopes, if you fix a time t, the vector of the slopes does not contain independent random variables. So far we've seen a model called solid-on-solid model. I'm going to talk about another model called Ginzburg-Landau model or fourth-order Ginzburg-Landau model, which is also a model for surface diffusion. So as before, we assume that we have a surface, a one-dimensional surface, with n sides, and the lattice of the site is periodic. HIN is the height of the surface at the site I over n. We define the slope of the surface at the site I over n to be the difference between two consecutive heights. And in this model, a configuration is the vector of the heights or the vector of the slopes. The difference between Ginzburg-Landau model and solid-on-solid model is that the height of the surface at the site can take any real number, whereas before the height could take just integer numbers, because it was the number of particles at that site. And each configuration has an energy associated that depends just on the slope profile of the surface. What is the dynamics of this model? S and t is the slope profile at the time t, and this evolves according to the law of a diffusion process, is a Markov process. Now, this one is supported on continuous paths. It preserves the sum of the slopes, and it has these measures as equilibrium measures. It's also reversible with respect to these equilibrium measures, and is ergodic if we fix the sum of the slopes. To describe a diffusion process, we have to write down what is the infinitesimal generator of the process. And this is a generator, is a symmetric operator fixed by this quadratic form. Note that in this quadratic form, we have a vector, xi, which is a vector in direction 1, negative 2, and 1. And you remember in the solid-on-solid model, this is how a configuration of slopes was updated. We also have a function a in this quadratic form. The Ginzburg-Landau model has a hydrodynamic scaling limit, and this hydrodynamic scaling limit is a fourth-order PDE. It's a fourth-order nonlinear equation, which is here. So what we do, we assume that for each n, we start the slow process in some non-equilibrium measure. Such that the sequence of empirical distribution corresponds to a certain initial profile, S0. Then we are going to look at QNT, the law of this measure value process given by the empirical distribution. So this is, this is a probability measure on measure value paths. And we have a sequence of probability measures. These probability measures this sequence has a limit, and the limit is supported on weak solutions of this PDE, of this nonlinear evolution equation. So unfortunately, at this point in time, I'm not able to prove the uniqueness of this Cauchy problem. If we had the uniqueness, we could say that at time t, the sequence of empirical distribution corresponds to the profile STU. We also have noticed that in this evolution equation, we have a coefficient, which is called the transport coefficient. And this transport coefficient depends on the model, depends on the function A that we take in the quadratic form. So the solution of this PDE gives us the evolution of the slope profile on the macro scale. Just to say a few words about this model, we can write down the stochastic differential system satisfied by the diffusion process, and it has this form. Notice that the first part is the discrete Laplacian of an object called microscopic current, and the second part is a martingale. If we assume that the function A is a constant function, then this object is the discrete Laplacian of the slope field, and we have a model called gradient model. If the function A is not constant, then this property is not satisfied, and we have a non-gradient model, for which it's very difficult to derive the hadronic scaling limit. What is the the model is this collection of diffusion processes that gives you the evolution of the surface on each scale. So here is the sketch of the proof of the hadronic scaling limit for the Ginzburg-Landa model. So remember, we would like to show that the limit of this model is a PDE. Therefore, we will look for a microscopic version of this PDE. For that, we look at the infinitesimal change in the empirical distribution. So we write the stochastic differential equation for the empirical distribution. Because the first part was the discrete Laplacian of an object, then we can integrate by parts twice. Unfortunately, we cannot proceed further because this microscopic current is not the discrete Laplacian of another function. Varandan's idea to find the hadronic scaling limit of a non-gradient model is to show that the microscopic current decomposes as a multiple of the discrete Laplacian of the slope field plus some fluctuations. If that is the case, then we can integrate by parts two more times, and then we are able to show that the limit of the model is given by this nonlinear PDE. So the main problem in deriving the hadronic scaling limit is to prove this fluctuation dissipation equation, to prove this decomposition. We would like to show that the current decomposes as a multiple of the Laplacian of the slope field plus rapid fluctuations. We would like to show that we can replace the current with the right-hand side here. When we do that, we have two control terms which have this scaling, 1 over n squared, and then an integral up to n to the 4. So we may think maybe a central limit theorem is present. So what we will do next, we will control terms like this by the central limit theorem variance. And we will use the central limit theorem variance to construct a Hilbert space structure on a certain set of functions. This Hilbert space is quite difficult to understand because the inner product is so difficult. It's given by the central limit theorem variance. So what we do, we actually construct an isomorphism with another Hilbert space that is easier to understand. And then for this Hilbert space, we would like to show that in this Hilbert space we have a decomposition like this, or we would like to show that the Hilbert space decomposes into one direction and a subspace. So here are the Hilbert spaces that I'm talking about. They are subspaces of the Gaussian space of a square integrable function on the set of sequences with this measure which has Gaussian marginals. And I'm going to consider a vector field with constant coefficients, and DJ is going to be the translation of this vector field. We also have the shift of acting on functions, and tau n is the n-fold composition of the shift. A function in this Gaussian space is called closed if it has this property, di tau jf is dj tau if for each I and j. And the function is called exact if it can be written in this form. Note that here we have an infinite sum. This infinite sum makes sense because g is a cylinder function, or a function which depends on finitely many coordinates. So this vector field kills all by finitely many terms in this infinite sum. So the space of exact function is the closed linear span of this set. So I would like to give you an explanation why do we call this function closed functions. So suppose we have a form. So all of this is just formal. We have this form, and we change the definition of the exterior derivatives using the translations of my vector field. Then if we consider the form to contain the shifts of the function, then this form is closed. In other words, d omega is zero for this exterior derivative if dj tau if is di tau jf. So this is the reason why we call this function closed. The main question that we ask is, what is the codimension of the space of exact functions inside of the space of closed functions? Of course, this will depend on the vector field that we consider. It's not very clear what this square is. It's just what can we say about this decomposition? If the vector field is very simple, it's just the derivative with respect to the zero position, then the space of closed function is the same as the space of exact functions. And this is called the Glauber case. If we change the vector field to have this form, d1 minus d0, then the space of exact functions has codimension 1 inside of the space of closed functions. And this is called the Kawasaki's case, and it's a result proved by Varadhan in 1990. The result that I had to prove to derive the Hadron-Niskanen limit of the Ginzburg-Landau field is if I consider this vector field, which is like a discrete Laplacian, or d1 minus 2 d0 plus d minus 1, then the space of exact functions has codimension 1 inside of the closed function. It is believed that if the sum of the coefficients of this vector field is 0, then the space of exact functions has codimension 1 inside of the space of closed functions. Otherwise, they are the same. But unfortunately, I didn't know how to prove that. So I have a vector field with constant coefficients. If the sum of the coefficients is 0, then the space of exact functions has codimension 1 inside of the space of the closed functions. Otherwise, they are the same. You can see this for B and C. So I would like to talk about how to prove this result. The main point is to observe that the Gaussian space is isomorphic with the symmetric Fock space of the space of square summable sequences. So in quantum probability, the symmetric Fock space is the Hilbert space of states of a system with an indefinite number of particles, or a system where we have a birth and death of particles. So this Fock space is the direct sum of the n particle spaces. To identify what is the n particle space inside of the Gaussian space, we have to remember that the Gaussian space has a very nice basis formed by Hermite polynomials. So for each multi-index with finitely many non-zero entries, we have the Hermite polynomials. We have a certain Hermite polynomial. And the n-particle space is the closed linear span of those Hermite polynomials corresponding to multi-indices with length n. If you like, H1 is the span of Xn, where n is in Z. So you should think of the elements in this basis are like basic states. So one particle can be in countable many states. So therefore, the state for an n particle should be given by a vector, or by this quotient space, the n factor by the symmetric group. So this is to understand that there is a bijective correspondence between the set of multi-indices with length n and this quotient space, the lattice factor by the action of the symmetric group. So if I have a multi-index is a sequence, and I can think that each position has a multiplicity equal with the entry on that position. And then we can repeat this position according to its multiplicity. So therefore, we get a vector in the lattice. And we don't care about the order of the entries. So we have a bijective correspondence between the n-particle space and this Hilbert space of functions, square summable functions defined on the lattice, which are Sn invariant. And this correspondence is given if we have a function in the n-particle space, then we expand this function in Fourier series, and then we collect the Fourier coefficients. And the Fourier coefficient gives us a function defined on the lattice, which is Sn invariant. so an interesting thing to note is that if we have a function that is closed, then any projection of the function in each n particle space is also closed. So the projection of the function in the in the zero particle space is just a multiple of the vacuum state, and we don't care about that. And to prove that this decomposition theorem is true, we have to approximate any closed function in an n particle space with exact functions. If we have a closed function or exact function, rather than looking at the function, we better look at the Fourier coefficients. And what can we say about the Fourier coefficient of the function? If the function is closed, then the function given by the Fourier coefficients is in the image of a certain operator. So this operator is like a second order discrete derivative in that direction 1, 1, 1. And also, this operator acts on a function which is S-n-tilde invariant. This group is a new group, is the smallest group containing the symmetric group and the next Schnorr reflection. If the function is exact, then also the function given by the Fourier coefficients is in the image of this operator, but now the operator acts on a function with compact support. So then we are left to show the following fact. Assume we have this operator that acts on function defined on the lattice, which are Sn tilde invariant, and produces a function defined on the lattice, which are Sn invariant. The operator is very simple. It has this form. And suppose we have a square summable function which is in the image of this operator. Can we find a sequence of compactly supportive functions such that we can approximate f hat with ACK? So how do we construct this approximation? The function that we start with is in the image of this operator. So we have to start from this function C. The function C is Sn tilde invariant, but it's not square summable. It doesn't have compact support. So what we have to do is to multiply this function with a cutoff function. So we will choose a particular cutoff function that is Sn tilde invariant. So this cutoff function is an average of characteristic functions of regions invariant under the action of this group. And then we show that the action of this operator on this function with compact support converges to f hat by estimating the errors terms in this in a c k phi k. The main inequality that we use to estimate these error terms is the spectral gap of a certain graph. So what do I mean by the spectral gap of a graph? If we have a graph with finitely many vertices, we can define a quadratic form. And this quadratic form produces a symmetric operator which has a sequence of eigenvalues. The first one is 0. And lambda 2 is the spectral gap of this graph. And we have to give an estimation on this spectral gap. So I think I'll stop here.